Hello, and welcome to today's deep dive. I want to take a second right off the bat to specifically welcome you,
Yes, absolutely.
especially if you're the KSU Construction Management student who,
Yeah.
might be sitting in a class like CM 6600 right now, or maybe you're just a learner out there who is absolutely fascinated by the hidden physical world of mega infrastructure.
It's a fascinating world to be stepping into.
It really is. You are stepping into a field that is literally building the backbone of the modern world. And today, we are going directly into the deep end of that reality. Think about this for a second. Every single time you stream a 4K video on your phone, every time you execute a stock trade, or type a prompt into a massive AI tool.
You think you're just interacting with the cloud?
Exactly. You think it's this invisible cloud, but there is no cloud. You are relying on massive, highly engineered physical structures. We are talking millions of cubic yards of concrete, staggering amounts of structural steel, miles of copper wiring, and these just industrial scale cooling systems.
Right. And it's a fundamental misconception that the digital world is somehow detached from the physical one.
Yeah.
The reality is quite the opposite. The digital world is intensely heavily physical,
Yeah.
and it relies on vast amounts of land, staggering amounts of energy, and incredibly precise engineering tolerances. So today, we are looking at the realities of how these colossal structures are actually brought into existence.
And the big question we're exploring today is how is that infrastructure actually built? And perhaps more importantly for you, a future construction professional, why is it so incredibly risky to construct?
That's the core of it.
To answer this, we are pulling from some really fantastic source material today. We have excerpts from a comprehensive guide called Critical Infrastructure and Data Center Lifecycle Management, as well as insights from the Mastering Data Center Construction Risk Guide.
And these sources are essential because they really move past the basic blueprints. They detail the intense daily pressures of building these facilities.
They don't just show you the finished product.
No, not at all. They unpack the massive financial stakes, the terrifying logistical bottlenecks, and the complex procurement strategies that project managers have to navigate every single day.
So our mission today is to explore how something as seemingly mundane as a single delayed generator at a factory can just cascade into a multi-million dollar disaster on the job site.
And how construction professionals actively mitigate these unique lifecycle risks from the very moment a site is chosen to the day the facility is eventually decommissioned.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the sheer scale of modern data centers is mind-boggling. We're not talking about a closet with a blinking router or, a standard tilt-up warehouse. We are talking about campuses that can span hundreds of acres. But before we get into the nuts and bolts of the concrete and the steel, we need to understand the fundamental nature of what we are building.
Today is really about understanding the why. Why are these buildings classified alongside massive power grids, municipal water supplies, and interstate highway systems as critical infrastructure?
That's a huge classification.
It is, and it's because they are no longer optional. They are foundational to the functioning of modern society.
Here's a teaser for you as we get started, something that completely shifted my perspective when I was reviewing the notes for this deep dive. In the world of data center construction, the building itself, the walls, the roof, pouring the concrete slab.
That isn't actually the schedule.
Right, that isn't the schedule. The schedule is dictated by a single piece of custom cooling equipment that has to be ordered nearly a year in advance. That one machine is the schedule. Everything else revolves around its delivery date.
It completely inverts how we traditionally think about constructing a commercial building. You aren't building a shelter for people. You are building a highly specialized envelope around extremely sensitive, long-lead machinery.
Which brings us to how we need to fundamentally redefine our concept of the warehouse. The sources emphasize that data centers have evolved dramatically. If you go back to the, I mean, back in the 1990s, a data center was often just a modest server room in the basement of an office building.
Just a few racks and a dedicated AC unit.
Yeah, exactly. Now, they have morphed into these sprawling campuses that consume the power of small cities. The guides describe them as socio-technical powerhouses. What does that term actually mean when you're sitting in an owner-architect contractor meeting?
Socio-technical highlights that these facilities are not just marvels of complex mechanical and electrical engineering. They're intimately intertwined with intense human decision-making.
Meaning all the stakeholders.
Exactly. You have owners, general contractors, highly specialized MEP vendors, utility providers, regulators, and environmental policymakers all interacting. The technology cannot function without the highly orchestrated human systems managing it.
But the human systems are answering to the machines.
Completely. The human systems are entirely beholden to the absolute unforgiving demands of the technology. You can't negotiate with a server that is overheating.
You really can't. And you mentioned earlier that they are classified as critical infrastructure. Let's dig into that classification. Why are they legally and operationally grouped with things like water supplies and transportation grids?
It comes down to a societal zero-tolerance policy for digital downtime. Think about it. If an interstate highway is closed for a day due to a bridge repair, traffic is rerouted. It's annoying, the supply chain slows down a bit, but society functions.
We just take a detour.
Right. But if a massive data center goes completely offline, the ramifications are immediate and catastrophic. Hospital records vanish, preventing life-saving procedures. Financial markets freeze, halting billions of dollars in trades. Emergency dispatch systems can fail.
It's the nervous system.
The digital infrastructure is the nervous system of modern society. When it fails, the societal body goes into shock.
The financial stakes attached to that zero-tolerance policy are just staggering. The sources highlight that a single power outage in a data center costs an average of $1.25 million.
Just one outage.
Just one. And if you are the construction manager building this facility, and you are delayed by just a single day past your contractual completion date, that can trigger seven-figure liquidated damages. Let's pause on that term, because for a CM student, liquidated damages, or LDs, are a terrifying reality. We aren't just talking about a vague penalty here.
No, liquidated damages are a pre-negotiated sum written directly into the construction contract. The owner is essentially saying, for every calendar day this facility is not generating revenue because you haven't handed over the keys, you owe us a specific amount of money to cover our projected losses.
And in standard commercial builds, that's what, a few thousand dollars a day?
Usually, yes. In a standard commercial build, LDs might be a few thousand dollars a day. Then a massive data center build, where the owner has already sold the server space to enterprise clients and promised them a live date. Missing that date means the owner is breaching their own contracts.
So the burn rate is astronomical.
Which is exactly why LDs can easily exceed $1 million for a single day of delay.
I want you to consider the immense pressure that places on a project team. If an office building is delayed by a month, what happens? The tenant company extends their current lease? Or people just work from home for a few more weeks? It's a headache, maybe some extra rent costs, but it isn't front page news.
But when a data center is delayed, or worse, if it fails during operations because of a construction flaw, local economies halt. Businesses cannot process transactions. The ripple effects are exponential. The construction manager isn't just managing concrete and steel. They are managing the literal continuity of the local and sometimes global economy.
To bring this right to your doorstep, especially for UKSU students, let's look at the real-world boom of data centers right here in Georgia. The state, and particularly the greater Atlanta and Marietta areas, has become a massive hub for data center development.
It's a major growth sector there.
It really is. And it's primarily driven by the need to support Atlanta's exploding fintech scene. Every time someone swipes a card or uses a digital wallet linked to one of those financial tech companies, billions of transactions are routing right through these local builds.
And that geographic reality adds another incredibly dense layer of complexity to the construction process. Building in Georgia means navigating specific climate realities. You are dealing with intense, prolonged summer heat waves and high humidity.
Don't forget the potential localized flooding.
Exactly. The feasibility of these sites is constantly challenged by the environment, which forces design engineers to create incredibly robust redundancies just to ensure the facility survives the local weather. You aren't just building for the servers, you are building against the climate.
So if the stakes are this incredibly high and the financial penalties for failure are astronomical, what exactly are we building? It isn't just one monolithic thing called a data center. I was surprised to read that there isn't just one type of blueprint.
Not at all.
There are actually different species of these buildings, each with its own unique ecosystem of risks. Which brings us to what the sources call the data center zoo.
The data center zoo is a perfect way to conceptualize it. The source material identifies six specific data center typologies. We have enterprise, colocation, hyperscale, edge, modular, and retrofit. As a future professional in this space, you have to understand that managing the construction of one is fundamentally different from managing another.
Each carries a profoundly unique set of lifecycle risks. Let's break these down, starting with the enterprise data center. This is the private, single-tenant facility. The organization builds it, owns it, and operates it exclusively for its own internal computing needs.
A closed loop.
Right. The sources give a fantastic real-world example here, JPMorgan Chase. They operate over 32 private enterprise data centers globally. They are processing over 10 billion transactions daily for their trading systems, risk analytics, and customer banking.
When you look at an enterprise facility like JPMorgan's, you're looking at an entity that requires absolute ironclad control over its environment. They need ultra-low latency for high-frequency trading.
Because speed is money.
Exactly. In that world, a microsecond's delay in a data transmission can cost millions of dollars in the financial markets. Because of that, they demand the absolute highest tier of physical and digital security and perfectly clean power.
But that control comes with a massive burden.
It does. The upfront capital required to build a bespoke facility like that is astronomical. Furthermore, the risk profile sits entirely on their own shoulders. If there is a single point failure because the design wasn't perfectly redundant, they have no one to blame but themselves.
Now let's contrast that private fortress with the absolute giants of the industry. Hyperscale. When we talk about hyperscale, we are talking about the titans. Google, Amazon, Microsoft. These are massive facilities designed to handle global web and cloud workloads.
Hyperscale is where the sheer physical footprint becomes difficult to comprehend. We are talking about campuses that look like small manufacturing cities, sometimes spanning millions of square feet across multiple buildings.
The scale is just unreal.
And the risks associated with building hyperscale are unique precisely because of their scale. They have such intense energy and water demands that the construction and operational risks become inherently political. You are dealing with massive carbon policy pressures.
Because you're drawing so much power.
You are negotiating power purchase agreements directly with regional utility grids because your facility might draw as much power as a neighboring town. You're also navigating incredibly strict water usage rights with local municipalities. Building a hyperscale facility is as much a diplomatic mission as it is a construction project.
On the complete opposite end of the size spectrum, we have edge data centers. These are small, highly distributed facilities pushed out closer to the end users. They exist to support low-latency applications like 5G networks, autonomous vehicle grids, or the Internet of Things.
Edge computing flips the construction risk matrix completely. Instead of managing one gigantic site with massive environmental politics, an edge construction manager is dealing with a logistical nightmare.
Managing a fleet instead of a campus.
Right. You're managing dozens, maybe hundreds, of microsites scattered across a wide geographic region. The risks there involve local grid volatility. You might be tying into older, less reliable municipal power grids that weren't designed for constant heavy loads.
And the local zoning.
Oh, exactly. You are dealing with highly variable local zoning laws for every single tiny site, coordinating dozens of different local permitting offices.
Then we have collocation facilities. These are the multi-tenant shared spaces. Think of it like a high-tech, highly secure apartment building for servers. Companies rent racks or sometimes entire secure steel cages within the larger facility.
It's a great business model for companies that want scalability without the massive upfront capital costs of building their own enterprise facility.
But the sources note the specific risks here revolve around shared security and compartmentalization. You have multiple different companies, perhaps even direct market competitors, physically accessing the same overarching building.
So the physical access controls in a collocation build must be flawless. You are building complex routing systems for power and network cables to ensure that a technician working on tenant A's equipment cannot physically or digitally accidentally interfere with tenant B's equipment. The compartmentalization is a massive design challenge.
We also have modular data centers. These are prefabricated, portable units that are assembled almost like building blocks for rapid deployment. The components are built in a factory, shipped on flatbed trucks, and assembled on site.
The primary risk here is the assembly timeline and transportation logistics.
Right, because if your prefabricated modules are delayed in transit, or if the heavy crawler cranes required to lift them aren't perfectly synchronized with the delivery trucks, your entire rapid deployment advantage evaporates.
Finally, we have retrofits. This involves taking an existing building, often an old industrial warehouse, or a defunct shopping mall, and converting it into a data center.
Owners do this hoping for cost savings and speed, leveraging the existing core and shell of the building. But the hidden architectural challenges can be severe, right?
Very severe. You are dealing with existing structural load limits. A 1980s warehouse roof was not designed to support the immense weight of modern industrial cooling equipment. the existing concrete floor slabs might not have the load-bearing capacity to handle the extreme, localized weight of dense battery racks.
So you end up retrofitting the retrofit.
You often end up spending millions on structural reinforcement, which eats into the cost savings you were hoping for.
As a learner and a future construction manager, how does this specific type of data center completely change your daily operational focus? If you are assigned to a hyperscale build, you are studying environmental impact reports and negotiating with regional water authorities.
And if you are on an edge rollout, you are managing a fleet of trucks delivering microunits to 50 different suburban street corners, fighting 50 different local zoning boards.
It demands an incredible amount of adaptability from the management team. You cannot apply a one-size-fits-all approach to data center construction. You have to deeply understand the business case and the specific typology you are building to accurately forecast where your risks will emerge.
But regardless of whether you are building a massive hyperscale campus or a tiny edge node, every single data center relies on the exact same beating heart. They all depend absolutely on the six critical infrastructure systems.
These six systems are the foundation. If even one of them fails, the entire socio-technical powerhouse comes to a grinding halt. We're talking about power, cooling, network, structure, security, and fire protection.
And the overarching goal, the holy grail that all these systems are striving for, is known in the industry as the rule of five nines.
Let's put five nines, meaning 99.999% uptime availability, in perspective. In a given calendar year, 99.999% uptime allows for roughly 5 minutes and 15 seconds of total downtime for the entire year.
5 minutes, that is the margin of error you are building toward. It is an astonishingly tight tolerance that dictates every single engineering decision made on the project.
I want to spend significant time doing a deep dive into the system that carries the heaviest burden to achieve those five nines. Power. Power is the undisputed king of the data center. The sources note that data centers currently consume between 1 and 2% of the entire global electricity supply.
It is a staggering statistic.
It really is. And it means the anatomy of the power system inside these facilities is incredibly complex. You don't just plug these servers into a wall socket. The power has to be conditioned, backed up, and perfectly distributed. Let's walk through that anatomy chronologically, starting from the outside in.
It begins with the utility feed connections. For a mission-critical facility, these are typically dual or redundant. That means you aren't just pulling power from one local substation.
You're pulling from multiple.
You are paying to have heavy high-voltage lines trenched in from two completely different utility substations, often on different regional grids. If one substation blows a transformer, your facility immediately relies on the other.
From the utility feed, the power goes into the medium-voltage switchgear. This is massive, room-sized equipment that takes the raw, high-voltage power from the grid and steps it down, distributing it to different sectors of the building.
Mm-hmm.
But the real magic happens at the ATS, the automatic transfer switches.
The ATS is a critical bridge. Let's simulate a failure. Imagine the utility grid goes down, say a severe storm knocks out both substations feeding your facility. The ATS detects that catastrophic loss of power in a matter of milliseconds. It immediately sends a start signal to the backup diesel generators. But here is the fundamental engineering problem. An industrial-scale diesel generator, the size of a locomotive engine, takes time to physically spin up, stabilize its RPMs, and produce clean, synchronized power. It might take 10, 20, or even 30 seconds to become fully operational.
In the data center world, a 30-second power loss means all the servers crash, active data is corrupted, and you've profoundly failed the five nines. So how do they bridge that terrifying 30-second gap between the grid failing and the generators taking the load?
That is the sole purpose of the UPS, the uninterruptible power supply.
Yep.
The UPS sits squarely between the utility power and the servers. During normal operations, it's constantly conditioning the utility power, stripping out any micro spikes or voltage sags to ensure perfectly clean sine waves are hitting the servers.
It acts as a filter.
Exactly. But the moment the ATS detects a utility failure, the UPS instantaneously, with 0 milliseconds of delay, begins pulling power from massive banks of batteries.
So the batteries carry the entire load of the data center for those crucial seconds while the diesel generators are waking up.
Precisely. The batteries are the sprinter, carrying the baton for the first leg of the emergency. Once the generators are up to speed and the power is stable, the ATS flips the physical connection, transferring the building's load over to the generators. The generators then power the data center and simultaneously begin recharging the depleted UPS batteries until the utility grid is eventually restored.
From the UPS, the clean power flows into PDUs, or power distribution units, located on the data hall floor. And this is where we need to talk about how that power actually reaches the server racks. I was reading about busways, which seem to be the modern standard over traditional wiring. What makes a busway different from just running heavy cables under the floor?
In older facilities, you would have hundreds of heavy, inflexible power cables, called WIPs, running underneath a raised floor, snaking their way up into the bottom of each server rack. It was a nightmare to manage, restricted airflow, and made upgrading power highly disruptive. Overhead busways revolutionized this.
How do they work?
Visually imagine a heavy-duty enclosed metal track suspended from the ceiling running directly above the rows of server racks. Inside this track are solid copper or aluminum bus bars carrying the current.
It's almost like the electrified third rail on a subway system, but suspended overhead.
That's a great analogy. And the beauty of a busway is its flexibility. Instead of hardwiring a cable all the way back to a PDU, technicians can simply snap a plug-in unit directly into the overhead busway at any point along the track and drop a short power cable right into the top of the server rack. It makes deploying new servers incredibly fast and keeps the floor space clear for cooling.
To ensure this highly choreographed relay race of electricity never fails, facilities utilize different levels of redundancy. The sources highlight two main tiers. Tier 3 requires N plus 1 redundancy. Can you explain the math behind that?
N is the baseline. It represents the exact minimum amount of equipment needed to run the facility at its full designed load. So if your facility requires 4 generators to run, N is 4. N plus 1 means you have the baseline equipment plus 1 spare of everything.
So you would install 5 generators.
Right. This architecture allows you to take one generator, or one UPS module, completely offline for routine maintenance or repairs without ever dropping power to the active servers.
Then you have the gold standard. Tier 3, which is 2N, that is fully redundant, fault-tolerant power paths.
2N means you literally have 2 of absolutely everything running simultaneously. 2 independent utility feeds, 2 completely separate switchgear rooms, 2 sets of UPS systems, 2 sets of generators. We call it an A side and a B side.
It's a mirror image.
These independent power paths run all the way down the busways to dual power supplies inside the individual server itself. If the entire A side of the building experiences a catastrophic electrical fire and explodes, the B side doesn't even blink. The servers keep running.
Building a 2N facility has to be phenomenally expensive. You are buying double the equipment, but only utilizing half of its capacity, which is why some of the biggest players are completely rethinking the architecture to cut costs without sacrificing reliability. I want to dive into one of my favorite examples from the sources, Google's power innovation.
Oh, this is a brilliant case study.
Google realized that relying on massive facility-level UPS battery rooms created a giant, expensive single point of failure, not to mention a massive loss of energy. So they changed the game with a custom 48-volt DC power architecture.
This is a paradigm shift in the industry. Let's look at the energy conversion problem first. Utility grids deliver AC, or alternating current. Servers run on DC, or direct current. In a traditional data center, the AC power hits the UPS, gets converted to DC to charge the batteries, gets converted back to AC to travel across the building, and then gets converted back to DC in the server's power supply.
That sounds incredibly inefficient.
It is. Every single time you convert power from AC to DC or vice versa, you lose energy in the form of heat.
What Google did was eliminate the giant centralized UPS battery room entirely. Instead, they run the power to the server racks and put individual 12-volt battery backups directly onto every single server tray.
It's a brilliant decentralization of risk. If a battery fails in a traditional setup, you could lose an entire data hall. In Google's architecture, if a battery fails, you lose one single server tray. Furthermore, by distributing the DC power this way and eliminating those massive conversion steps, the sources note Google reduced their energy conversion losses by 30%.
30%. When you're drawing the power of a small city, a 30% efficiency gain equates to millions of dollars in annual savings.
And a massive reduction in your carbon footprint. They've deployed this custom approach across all of their global campuses. It also frees up the physical real estate that a giant battery room used to occupy, allowing them to install more revenue-generating servers.
Another great example of power resilience from the sources is the Equinix SY4 facility in Sydney, Australia. They utilized a 2N fully redundant power architecture, drawing from dual utility feeds from totally separate substations. But what makes them unique is their use of modular rotary UPS systems.
Those are incredible machines.
Instead of rooms full of chemical batteries, a rotary UPS uses kinetic energy stored in a massive, heavy spinning flywheel to bridge that power gap we talked about. In 2019, Sydney experienced a major grid event that knocked out power to wide swaths of the city. But because of this incredibly robust Tier 4-style architecture, the Equinix facility sailed right through it. The servers inside never even knew the outside world went dark.
That is the ultimate goal. The power system is the shield wall. But right behind power is the second most critical system, and the one that physically dictates the layout of the entire building. Cooling.
Let's break down cooling. As the sources point out, treating data center cooling like a standard commercial HVAC system is a rookie mistake that will quite literally melt your servers. I want to pull on that thread because understanding the difference between latent heat and sensible heat is crucial here.
A standard office HVAC system is designed primarily for human comfort. It handles latent heat, which is moisture and humidity, from people breathing, sweating, and making coffee, along with sensible heat from the sun hitting the windows. An office AC turns on, blasts cold air until the wall thermostat is happy, and turns off.
But a data center is different.
A data center is a completely alien environment. It produces almost entirely sensible heat. This is intense, dry, continuous heat radiating from thousands of microprocessors running at maximum computational capacity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's no moisture to remove.
So if the cooling stops...
the ambient temperature in a server aisle doesn't just get uncomfortable. Can reach catastrophic equipment destroying levels in a matter of 2 to 3 minutes. The plastic components literally begin to warp.
The sources specifically highlight the difference between a CRA unit and a CRAH unit. Let's define those. CRAA stands for computer room air conditioning. This uses direct expansion refrigerant, kind of like a giant industrial version of the AC unit sitting outside your house. But the heavy lifter in large-scale facilities is the CRAH unit.
CRAH stands for computer room air handling. The key letter there is the H. The sources emphasize the H stands for hydronics, meaning it uses water. CRAH units do not use volatile chemical refrigerants internally. Instead, they use massive fans to pull the hot air from the server room and pass it over dense metal coils filled with chilled water.
And that water absorbs the heat.
That chilled water absorbs the heat from the air, and the newly cooled air is blasted back into the server aisles. The now warm water is piped out of the building to massive chiller plants and cooling towers located in the equipment yard, where the heat is rejected into the atmosphere, and the water is chilled and sent back in.
A lot of people might wonder, why pipe thousands of gallons of water into a room filled with hypersensitive electrical equipment? Why is chilled water better than refrigerant for these massive buildings?
Precision and scale. Water has a tremendous thermodynamic capacity to absorb and move heat, far greater than air or standard refrigerants. Using a hydronic CRH system allows for ultra-precise environmental control over temperature and humidity across massive, cavernous data halls.
It's just vastly more efficient at a hyperscale level.
Exactly. Far better than trying to pump high-pressure, expensive, and environmentally hazardous refrigerants all over a 100-acre campus. The piping requires incredible welding and leak detection systems, but the thermal efficiency is unmatched.
So we have power keeping the servers on and cooling keeping them from melting. Let's dig into the other systems that often get overlooked but are equally critical. Let's look at security. We aren't just talking about a building with a rent-a-cop at the front desk and a badge reader. These are multi-layered physical and digital fortresses.
The physical security begins at the property line. You have anti-ram perimeter fencing with concrete bollards designed to stop a heavy truck driving at high speeds. The entrances utilize man traps.
Those are intense.
They are. They are small, enclosed vestibules where the outer door must close and lock behind a person before the inner door will open, preventing tailgating. Inside, access is governed by multi-factor biometrics, combining badge swipes with iris scanners, facial recognition, or fingerprint readers. This is all monitored by ubiquitous CCTV coverage and dedicated SOC's security operations centers staffed 247 by analysts monitoring every single anomaly.
Then there is the structure itself. Building a data center requires specialized architectural elements. Historically, this meant complex raised flooring systems. The concrete slab would be poured, and then a false floor made of removable steel tiles would be built 2 or 3 feet above it. The CRAH units would pump freezing cold air down into that underfloor plenum, creating a pressurized zone of cold air that would shoot up through perforated tiles directly in front of the server racks.
And beyond the flooring, in many regions like California or Japan, the structure requires intense seismic base isolation. You can't just bolt the servers to the floor and hope for the best during an earthquake. The shear forces would snap the fiber optic connections and the rigid chilled water pipes.
So how do they protect it?
Engineers use technologies like friction pendulum bearings. The entire structural foundation of the building rests on these massive steel balls. When an earthquake hits, the ground moves violently underneath the building. But the building itself glides smoothly within these balls, isolating the fragile servers and rigid piping from the destructive kinetic energy.
That is incredible engineering. Finally, let's talk about fire protection. You obviously cannot just install standard ceiling sprinklers in a data hall. If you dump thousands of gallons of water on running servers, you've ruined the equipment just as thoroughly as the fire would have, so they use specialized waterless suppression systems.
Waterless suppression relies on specialized inert gases, like Novec 1230 or FM200. These are clean agents stored as liquids in pressurized cylinders, but discharged as a gas. When a fire is detected, the system floods the room with this gas.
It essentially suffocates the fire without suffocating the room.
Right. It extinguishes the fire in seconds, not by dousing it, but by rapidly absorbing the heat or disrupting the combustion reaction at a molecular level, dropping the temperature below the ignition point. And it does this without removing the oxygen, so it is safe for technicians who might be in the room, and it leaves absolutely zero residue that would destroy the microchips.
There's a fascinating technical nugget about these gas systems from the sources. In the early days of waterless suppression, when the massive tanks discharged the pressurized gas into the room, the acoustic shock wave, the literal sheer volume of the sound, was so loud that the physical sound waves would vibrate the spinning platters inside the hard drives until they shattered. They were destroying the data with sound to save it from fire.
It's wild to think about.
Modern systems have to use specialized acoustic nozzles to muffle the discharge and protect the hardware.
It's a perfect example of the compounding complexities in these buildings. Solving one problem often creates a new, highly specific engineering challenge.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Designing these six critical systems on a computer screen is one thing. Actually procuring the parts to build them in the real world, that is a literal nightmare. And that brings us to the core of construction risk, the domino chain, critical paths, and long-lead equipment.
This is where the pristine theory of engineering meets the brutal reality of global supply chains. Building a data center is fundamentally not like building an office. If you are building a commercial office tower and you need standard rooftop AC units, lighting fixtures, or drywall, you can often buy them off the shelf or with a very short lead time from a local distributor.
But the most critical components of a data center, those massive rotary UPS systems, the industrial-scale locomotive diesel generators, and those specialized hydronic CRAH units we just explored, you cannot just go to a commercial supplier and pick one up.
No, they do not sit in a warehouse waiting for a buyer. They are highly customized, engineered-to-order machines tailored to the exact voltage, footprint, and thermal loads of your specific facility.
Because they are bespoke, custom-built machines, the manufacturing lead times are staggering. The sources state these items routinely require 30 to 50 plus weeks of lead time. That is a massive timeline. From the moment you sign the multi-million dollar purchase order, you are waiting nearly a full calendar year before that equipment actually rolls off the factory floor in Germany or Japan and gets put on a cargo ship.
To understand why a 50-week wait is so terrifying for a construction management team, we have to look closely at project scheduling. The sources highlight the concept of the critical path. For a CM student, you live and breathe Primavera P6 or Microsoft project schedules. You know what a Gantt chart is.
It's the backbone of the project.
Right. Every project has a critical path, which is the longest continuous sequence of interdependent tasks that dictates the absolute minimum time the project can be completed.
The key concept here is float or slack. Tasks that are not on the critical path have float. If you are painting the interior offices of the data center and the paint crew is delayed by 3 days, it doesn't matter. You have weeks of float before the building opens. Painting does not impact the final completion date.
But tasks on the critical path have zero float. If a task on the critical path is delayed by 1 week, the final completion date of the entire multi-hundred-million-dollar project is delayed by exactly 1 week.
In data center construction, the procurement, manufacturing, and delivery of long-lead equipment like generators and CRAH units is almost always sitting dead center on the critical path. The procurement becomes the schedule. You are essentially building a concrete box while waiting a year for the engine to arrive.
The sources emphasize the extreme danger of what they call the domino chain. Because these construction tasks are sequentially interdependent, a delay at the factory doesn't just push back a delivery date on a spreadsheet. It triggers a catastrophic cascade of delays on the physical construction site, completely ruining your trade stacking.
Let's visualize that domino chain in detail. Say your custom diesel generator is delayed by just 2 weeks at the manufacturing plant due to a minor parts shortage. You cannot just build around it and do other things. If that generator isn't sitting on the concrete pad, the heavy rigging crew you hired to mobilize a 500-ton crawler crane to lift it cannot do their job.
So you have to cancel and reschedule the crane.
But specialized crane operators might be booked out for another month on other jobs.
And the chain continues. Because the generator isn't set, the specialized electrical contractors cannot begin pulling the heavy copper cables to connect it to the switchgear. Because the power isn't physically connected, the third-party commissioning agents cannot begin testing the system to prove it hits the five nines.
Every subsequent trade is delayed. You have highly skilled, incredibly expensive labor sitting idle on your site. The mental toll this takes on a construction management team is immense. You are watching a minor 2-week factory delay halfway across the world translate directly into a massive financial catastrophe on your site. You are bleeding money on idle labor, your project completion date is slipping, and the clock is ticking loudly toward those $1 million a day liquidated damages.
It is a high-wire act with zero float. The sheer terror of managing a critical path dictated by global manufacturing is what keeps data center project managers awake at night. A few weeks' delay is not an inconvenience. It is a fundamental mission failure.
If the risks associated with buying this equipment are this terrifying, it raises a massive strategic question. How do the people in charge decide who is actually responsible for buying it? Who holds the contract and therefore who holds the risk? This leads us directly into our discussion on procurement models.
Because the equipment is the schedule, the procurement strategy is not an administrative afterthought decided by an accountant. It is a core strategic trade-off, negotiated heavily before the dirt is even moved. The sources outline two primary procurement models used to acquire this long-lead equipment. Direct owner purchasing, often called OFCI, versus GC-led procurement, or CFCI.
Let's look at direct owner purchasing, the OFCI model, first. The appeal here is pretty straightforward. The data center owner, let's say it's a giant tech company building a hyperscale facility, goes directly to the manufacturer of the UPS systems and signs the purchase order themselves. By cutting out the middleman, which is the general contractor, they save a massive amount of money.
Because GCs typically charge a percentage fee and a markup on everything they procure for the project to cover their overhead and risk.
Right. When you're buying $50 million worth of custom generators, avoiding a 5 or 10% GC markup saves millions of dollars right off the top. Plus, the owner gets maximum direct contractual control over the exact engineering specifications.
It sounds ideal on a spreadsheet. But what's fascinating here is the hidden burden that comes with that control. It's a fundamental rule of construction. Whoever holds the purchase order holds the risk. When the owner buys it directly, they completely assume all the risks associated with coordination, shipping, delivery, and storage. And in complex construction, timing is rarely perfect.
Let's explore what happens when the timing gets out of sync.
Let's say the manufacturer is highly efficient and actually finishes that massive UPS system 2 months early. Or, conversely, the construction site falls behind schedule due to severe weather delaying the pouring of a concrete foundation. Now, you have a multi-million-dollar, incredibly sensitive piece of electronic equipment ready to leave the factory. But the room it needs to sit in doesn't have a roof yet.
That's a huge problem.
Because the owner bought it directly, The manufacturer calls the owner and says, "The equipment is done. We're shipping it. Where do you want it?" The GC is going to step back and say, "That's not my problem. It's an OFCI contract. I'm not taking liability for it."
So now the owner's project managers are scrambling?
Exactly. The owner must suddenly find, lease, and fund a secure, climate-controlled warehouse to store this massive equipment. They have to arrange specialized flatbed transport from the port to the warehouse, insure it heavily while it sits there, and then pay for specialized transport again when the site is finally ready to receive it. The savings from cutting out the GC's markup can evaporate incredibly quickly in emergency logistics, double handling, and storage fees.
That is the intense risk of flying solo. Let's look at the alternative, GC-led procurement, the CFCI model. In this model, the owner hands the responsibility entirely to the general contractor. The GC signs the purchase orders, manages the factory schedule, and coordinates the delivery windows.
The primary advantage here is total risk transfer and simplicity for the owner. The GC takes on the physical and logistical nightmare. If that 40-ton generator needs to be craned onto a concrete pad, the GC ensures the crawler crane is mobilized on the exact right day, the riggers are prepped, the site access roads are compacted to handle the weight, and the path is clear. If the equipment arrives early from the factory, it is entirely the GC's headache and financial responsibility to find safe storage.
But the trade-off is that this peace of mind is extraordinarily expensive. The GC is going to add their massive fee and markup to the cost of that equipment specifically to compensate for taking on that massive logistical risk.
Beyond the financial premium, it requires the owner to have absolute, unwavering trust in the GC's MEP expertise. Data center MEP is vastly more complex than standard commercial MEP. The GC must deeply understand the intricacies of hydronic CRAH units and 2N power architectures to effectively manage those specialized vendors during the submittal and manufacturing process. If the GC makes a procurement error or fails to catch a defect during factory testing, the owner still suffers the ultimate delay in opening their facility.
I want you to think about this dynamic. If you are sitting in the owner's chair reviewing these contracts, which model do you choose? It really depends on an honest assessment of your organization's internal strength. If you are a massive tech giant building your 20th hyperscale campus, you probably have a massive in-house team of engineers, supply chain analysts, and logistics experts. You have the institutional muscle to buy direct, manage the storage risks, and pocket the savings.
However, if you are a regional bank building a one-off enterprise facility to house your core banking servers, you likely do not have a team of global logistics experts on staff. In that scenario, you will absolutely pay the premium for the GC-led model to make the headache go away. You are paying for risk mitigation and a single point of accountability.
But here's the brutal truth of the modern world that the sources hammer home. Regardless of who signs the check, whether it's the massive tech owner or the experienced GC, the global supply chain does not care about your contract. It is highly volatile. You can sign all the purchase orders you want, but how do you actually guarantee the factory builds your machine on time? This brings us to the strategies for beating the supply chain and mitigating that volatility.
The sources make it very clear that global supply chains are inherently fragile and unpredictable. A single microchip shortage in a Taiwanese fabrication plant, a labor strike at a major West Coast shipping port, or a disrupted shipping lane like we've seen with blockages in the Suez Canal, can instantly derail a carefully planned 50-week timeline. Construction teams cannot just place an order, sit back, and hope the equipment arrives. They have to actively manage and survive the supply chain using strict, aggressive mitigation tactics.
The first tactic the sources detail is fascinating. It's almost like a high-stakes poker game played years in advance. Early manufacturing slot reservations.
Because the waitlist for factories that build these custom CRAH units and generators are so long, construction teams simply cannot wait for the architects and engineers to finish the final 100% construction documents. If you wait until the blueprints are perfect to order the equipment, your project is already a year behind schedule. Long before the building is fully designed, they must secure a place in the factory's manufacturing queue.
How do you buy a custom engineered-to-order machine when you don't even know exactly what specifications you need yet?
You use letters of intent, or LOIs, accompanied by massive cash deposits. You approach the manufacturer and say, I don't have the exact voltage or thermal specifications finalized yet, but based on our preliminary design, I know I'm going to need roughly 4 megawatts of backup power next October. Here is a multi-million dollar deposit to reserve a block of manufacturing time on your assembly line for next summer.
It's a reservation fee.
It is a massive financial gamble based on early, rough estimates. But in this industry, it is the only way to ensure the equipment will be ready when the site eventually needs it.
Once you've reserved that slot, you still have to protect yourself against wild price swings. That is where advanced purchase agreements come in. The sources explain that these agreements lock in material prices and delivery timelines months, sometimes years, in advance. This insulates the overall project budget from market volatility.
Think about the raw materials required for a data center. You need miles and miles of heavy copper cabling for the power distribution and thousands of tons of structural steel. These are global commodities. If a geopolitical event suddenly causes the global price of copper to spike by 40%, a project without an advance purchase agreement could see its electrical budget blown out by tens of millions of dollars overnight. Locking those unit prices in early transfers, that raw material market volatility risk back to the supplier, ensuring budget certainty for the owner.
But what happens when you perfectly execute your early reservation? The factory builds the generator perfectly on time, but the physical construction site is delayed by 2 months of torrential rain. We touched on this briefly during the procurement discussion, but the sources provide a specific mitigation strategy for it: storage and transit protocols.
As we established, site readiness rarely aligns perfectly with factory output. It is a constant stressful dance. When the equipment is ready to ship, but the site is a muddy swamp, teams utilize 3PL companies, third-party logistics providers. These are specialized firms whose entire business model revolves around managing complex freight, heavy hauling, and specialized storage.
They aren't just dumping a multi-million-dollar UPS system in a dusty, unsecure warehouse.
Absolutely not. These are highly sensitive, easily damaged electrical components. A 3PL will take the finished equipment directly from the factory and hold it in highly secure, climate-controlled, and humidity-monitored facilities. They act as a strategic buffer zone. They hold the equipment safe, maintaining its warranty conditions, until the exact moment the concrete pad is cured and the riggers are mobilized on site. Utilizing a 3PL is a vital logistical hack to decouple the rigid factory manufacturing schedule from the chaotic, weather-dependent reality of the construction site schedule.
The final supply chain mitigation strategy the sources emphasize is vendor vetting. You cannot just go with the lowest bidder to save a few bucks. The mechanical, electrical, and plumbing vendors must be subjected to intense, almost forensic scrutiny.
The vetting process for a mission-critical facility is incredibly rigorous. First, you vet them for long-term financial stability. If you give a vendor a massive cash deposit for a generator that takes 50 weeks to build, you need to be absolutely certain that company won't declare bankruptcy in month 6, taking your deposit and your place in line with them. Second, you rigorously vet their proven history of mission-critical installations. Have they actually built equipment for a Tier 4 data center before? Do they truly understand the zero downtime stakes, or are they used to building standard office parks?
Crucially, the sources note these vendors must offer transparent, real-time tracking systems. The construction team needs to be able to monitor the manufacturing and shipping status minute by minute. A project manager shouldn't have to guess where a critical piece of equipment is. They should be able to log into a portal and see that the CRAH unit is currently in final witness testing on the factory floor, or that the switchgear has cleared customs at the port in Los Angeles.
Visibility is the only effective way to manage supply chain panic. If you can see a parts delay coming 3 months in advance, you have the float to adjust the site schedule, resequence other trades, and mitigate the damage. If you are flying blind and relying on hopeful emails, a delay becomes a catastrophe.
We've navigated the feasibility. We've survived the terrifying gauntlet of the critical path. We've utilized 3PLs to beat the supply chain, and the data center is finally built, commissioned, and powered on. The servers are humming. But the story doesn't end there. Which brings us to our final topic. The bookends, feasibility to e-waste, focusing on the entire lifecycle management of the facility.
The sources make a compelling point that the true lifecycle of a data center begins long before the first shovel hits the dirt, and it ends long after the servers finally boot down for the last time. We spent a lot of time deep in the weeds of construction, but let's look back at the starting line, the feasibility phase.
Siting a data center is an incredible multivariable puzzle. You are not just driving around looking for cheap, flat land. The sources point out you have to assess access to reliable, massive, high-voltage power grids. You need proximity to major high-speed fiber-optic network backbones to ensure low latency. And you desperately need access to vast amounts of water for those hydronic CRAH cooling systems we discussed.
Tying back to our earlier discussion about the boom in Georgia, the feasibility phase requires a deep, scientific assessment of climate extremes. You have to look at historical meteorological data and future climate projections. If a region is prone to severe, prolonged heat waves, you know your cooling systems will have to work overtime. This drastically increases your operational costs and your water usage. If the site is near a floodplain, you might have to build the entire massive facility on elevated structural piers or build immense retaining walls, which balloons your initial construction budget. These early environmental realities force engineers to design costly structural redundancies just to ensure the site is viable from day one.
Once the facility is viable and operating, the operations phase becomes a constant high-stress balancing act of trade-offs. The sources highlight this tension perfectly. If your corporate sustainability policy dictates prioritizing low carbon emissions, you might rely heavily on evaporative cooling, which drastically increases your daily water usage. However, if you are located in a drought-stricken area and face municipal mandates to save water, you have to use more electricity to run mechanical chillers, which in turn increases your carbon footprint.
There is no perfect, harmonious operational state. It is a continuous, daily navigation of competing priorities, balancing carbon output, water consumption, operational costs, and that absolute demand for 99.999% reliability is the daily reality of a facility manager. If you push too hard to save a few dollars on maintenance, you drop your resilience and you risk triggering that $1.25 million outage.
Eventually, like all things, every piece of technology reaches the end of its life. What happens when a data center dies? The sources are clear that it is not a traditional wrecking ball situation. You don't just mobilize a bulldozer and crush a building full of hazardous batteries, heavy metals, and toxic coolants.
The end of life phase is about a concept called circularity. It is a highly specialized, intensely regulated decommissioning process. It involves carefully cataloging and safely removing thousands of highly toxic lead acid or volatile lithium ion UPS batteries. It involves painstakingly recovering the massive copper coils from the CRAH units, extracting the rare earth metals from the server blades, and pulling miles of specialized cabling to be melted down. The primary goal is to refurbish what can be reused in other facilities and rigorously recover raw materials to drastically cut environmental waste.
It is about navigating constantly evolving environmental regulations to ensure that the physical skeleton of the digital world doesn't become a toxic legacy in a landfill.
The life cycle requires exactly as much engineering discipline and rigorous planning at the end of its life as it did during the initial design phase.
This has been an absolutely massive journey today. We started by redefining the warehouse, understanding the complex socio-technical beast that is a data center, and exploring why society has an absolute zero-tolerance policy for them going dark. We explored the data center zoo, contrasting JP Morgan's highly secure enterprise fortresses with the sprawling, power-hungry hyperscale campuses. We dove deep into the architectural weeds of the six critical systems, how Google reinvented power distribution with 48V DC, why CRAH units use chilled water instead of refrigerant to handle sensible heat, and how acoustic nozzles prevent fire suppression gas from destroying hard drives. We unpacked the terrifying reality of 50-week lead times, the unforgiving domino chain of the critical path, and the high-stakes poker game of early slot reservations and complex procurement trade-offs.
To you, the learner, and perhaps the future construction professional, heading out to actually build these incredible structures. Managing these buildings is ultimately about sequential decision-making under intense, unyielding uncertainty. The challenges you will face will not just be technical. They will be logistical, contractual, and environmental. Balancing carbon policies, water rights, budget constraints, and absolute 99.999% reliability while navigating a highly volatile global supply chain will be the defining challenge of your career in this sector.
It truly is an incredible high-stakes field. As we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final, unexamined idea to mull over, something that builds on everything we've discussed today. We know that the technology inside the data center, the massive AI chips, the advanced servers, the hyper-fast processors, evolves incredibly fast, often becoming functionally obsolete every 18 to 24 months. But we just learned that the custom physical infrastructure required to power and cool that rapidly changing technology requires a 50-week lead time just to be manufactured, let alone built into a facility. So think about this. How long until the speed of digital innovation actually outpaces the physical world's ability to pour the concrete, pull the copper, and build the cooling units necessary to support it? Are we approaching a physical logistical speed limit on the growth of the cloud?
It's a profound structural question. We are watching a real-time collision between the exponential speed of software and the unavoidable physical inertia of hardware and construction.
Something to ponder the next time you fire up a new AI tool and expect an instant answer. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the physical reality of the digital world. I keep questioning the hidden mega infrastructure behind your screen. Until next time.